Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
I'm excited about this, Andrew.
Yeah, I know. This is kind of a special podcast. Obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about the USA and Brazil and some of the UEFA Nations League things that have happened over the weekend. But we are gathered here on this Monday to talk to Daniel Story, who has a really fascinating book coming out September 20th. It's called Gaza in Italy. It's Daniel Story's in-depth profile of Paul Gascoigne's years playing with Lazio in Serie A, the ups, the downs, the controversies. It's all in there. It's an amazing read. You can pre-order a copy now on Amazon. It comes out September 20th. What's that, like a week and a half or so from now?
I've already had it on the audiobook.
Oh, very cool.
I couldn't wait.
It's James Richardson, right?
James Richardson's The Dulcet Tones. And
yeah.
It brought me back to actually this moment in time.
That's right. You love this song.
It was my ringtone.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Saturday morning, Gazzetta Football Italia on Channel 4. A very erudite Englishman sat outside some cafe bar looking at papers that were printed in pink, like Corriere dello Sport and all those things. And then we get the highlights package of Italian football, which was just perfect because some of the games were quite catenaccio, quite boring.
Well, that's very cool, and I'm glad to take that trip down memory lane with you. And we bring in now the author of Gaza in Italy. It is Daniel Story on the program with us. Daniel, what's up, man? How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We're really intrigued by this book because Gaza is such an intriguing figure, both in England and in Italy, of course, and you profile his years in Italy. I guess I kind of want to start from the beginning with you. I mean, can you tell us about his move to Serie A? Was it celebrated? Was he essentially, I mean, from what I gather, he's kind of like welcomed in almost as like a conquering hero.
Yeah, he is. It came about principally because of World Cup 90 held in Italy, obviously, which kind of brought Gaza and English football in general out of its shell, how it was viewed abroad. English teams had been banned from European football during the 80s after the high school disaster. And there was a kind of stereotype of English football that it was still very much kick and rush and a very physical game, and that we didn't produce flair players, and that the flair players we did produce generally went abroad. Glenn Hoddle, Chris Waddle had already done that before Italia 90. And Gaza was a kind of poster boy of this reawakening of English football in the eyes of the European audience. He was England's best player in that tournament. He was England's youngest player in that tournament. And he also exited that tournament on a personal note by getting booked in the semi-final that meant if England had got through, which they didn't in the end, he would have missed the final. And it kind of gave him this personal mini tragedy, which fueled his desire to move to Italy and kind of recapture the mood of that time. The club that attracted him, Lazio, had kind of fallen on hard times, but had a new owner that had these grand ideas and very much saw Gaza as this kind of standard bearer for a new Lazio to take them back where he believed they belonged, but to do so with a bit of flair and to do so with a bit of culture and fun. And Gaza fitted that perfectly. So, yeah, his initial move was delayed by a series of injuries. Both pretty much self-inflicted in terms of him being in the wrong place and doing things he shouldn't. But, yeah, he was welcomed over there initially.
Daniel, when you approach a book like this, particularly about Gaza, how difficult is it to write from a different perspective that isn't just a litany of banter and the stories that you would see him do in a club right now, actually, is what he's doing, telling stories of his career. How difficult is it just to kind of to stick with the facts and look at Gaza in a new way outside of the banter?
Yeah, I would never pretend to speak for Paul, but I do think that he even now has a warped sense, or perhaps not enough sense at all, of how he's been treated in this country and by, you know, principally by our country's media, our tabloid media, that we're coming from a place in the 90s where mental health issues and addiction, particularly in sports stars, was not understood. And to be brutally honest, they didn't want to understand it. Gaza was great value. He was great business for newspapers, both in England and in Italy. And I wanted to tell a very brutal account of that mental illness. And I hope I've done that. You know, it doesn't pretend to be positive. It doesn't pretend to be wholly celebratory. And it doesn't even really pretend to answer the question of whether this move was good or bad. It merely presents both sides of that argument. And as ever with Gaza, both sides of that argument are incredibly extreme.
Was he cooperative with this book? Is he aware of it? Have you heard from him?
Yeah, the publishers, HarperCollins, made the decision not to use him as, you know, as an interviewer, an interviewee effectively for the book, because firstly, Gaza can be in very different places at different times. And I mean that, you know, I mean that metaphorically and emotionally rather than geographically. He is a man who will always say that he will never beat addiction. He'll only ever fight it. And I think that the publishers certainly wanted to give an account of Gaza that was incredibly and, you know, absolutely appropriately sympathetic to him. You know, when it talks about his problems, this is because Paul has an illness. It's not because, you know, he's a sufferer. It's not because he's done things wrong, in my mind. And I wanted to present that Cassandra case. He is aware of the book and there's been no indication that he loves the book or has read the book or hates the book. But yeah, he's aware of it. But we didn't really want to use, we didn't want this to be an interview. You know, he's done countless autobiographies. He's had biographies written about him, some of which he's gone to court over because he wasn't happy with. This was intended to be, and I hope is, a very sympathetic look at his demons and also a celebration of his immense talent.
Yeah, I think it is. And having listened to the audiobook, I think you're very fair to him in that regard. You made the point in an interview recently, Daniel, that Gaza was a moments player, particularly while he was in Italy. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, firstly, no one would ever pretend that Paul was consistent over a period of time, or either within the same match or over a period of matches. I think he probably was at Newcastle where he started when he was young, but I think his first serious injury at Tottenham before leaving for Italy kind of curtailed that. He suffered a litany of muscle injuries and also of fitness issues. But he had an incredible talent. I would still say now he's certainly the most talented English player of my lifetime, and arguably in terms of natural talent ever. And when everything was going well, that occasionally was produced. There's a goal he scored for Lazio against Pescara in his first season, which sums him up perfectly. You know, he collects the ball and ghosts past six or seven players, making them all look foolish. And the crowd celebrate and no doubt also say to each other, why can't he do this every week? But I think the part of the ingredient of a cult hero, of which Paul certainly was, is that they are moments players, is that you didn't really know what you were going to get, that the dice was rolled and sometimes you got a six and sometimes you got a two or a three, because that was the very nature of flawed genius.
This might be kind of a big overarching question, but the fans in Italy, I mean, how did they feel about him? I know when he arrived, they were overjoyed, but over the course of his time there, like, is he remembered fondly by Italian fans when you bring up his name, or do people roll their eyes at it? How is he remembered there?
I think we have to split that into two camps. Firstly, Lazio supporters love Paul. He went back in Euro 2012 and Lazio played Tottenham in a Europa League game. He was invited as a guest of Lazio for that game and was paraded around the track as if he'd left the day before. And, you know, there were posters there saying, you know, this is always your home, we miss you, Paul, et cetera, et cetera. And they were not, you know, they're not false epithets. They represent a very deep affinity with Gascoigne. But as a whole, in Italian football, judges him as a wasted talent. There's a guy called John Foote who wrote pretty much the Bible on Italian football in an English language version called Calcio. And he talks about a man who appeared on the front of videos as by a rubbish bin because he was seen as a waste of talent. And Italian football in general deals pretty difficultly with maverick talents. We've seen that with Mario Balotelli in recent years. It prefers consistency in its stars, the likes of Francesco Totti and Paolo Maldini and Franco Baresi. They're kind of known for their consistency. So it doesn't deal very well with that idea of a flawed genius and a moments player. But yeah, we have to separate them out. Lazio love him. The rest of Italian football kind of passes him by.
I'm sure there's a decorum issue as well, because you spoke about how the stereotype of the English footballer, I think the Italian press may have wanted to paint Gazza as a hooligan as well. And certainly, I mean, making comments about the owner's daughter's breasts didn't help, did it, Daniel?
No, he didn't. I mean, Paul never has and never had a second gear or an off switch. What you saw was what you get for better or worse. And there's no doubt that Rome and Lazio saw both sides of that. He had no sense of, as you say, decorum. I think that's a perfect word for it, because he had no sense of acting in the right place at the right time. He acted exactly on the pitch as he did off, and that's on instinct. He didn't second guess everything. He didn't really think about his actions before his words. And all of those things sit pretty badly with Italian football culture, because as well as enjoying consistency on the pitch, they very much appreciate their stars to fall into line in terms of behaviour and reverence to the game in general. And Paul never really did that. There was the most famous incident is he'd been dropped by Lazio, or he wasn't fit for Lazio for a game against Juventus, and he was in the director's box and he belched live on TV. And now Paul's excuse is, "I didn't realise I was live on TV," but that doesn't really wash with the Italian public. So he was always going to be hounded by the media for those sort of incidents. And let's be frank, he didn't help himself there. But this was not Paul playing up. This was just him being who he was, really.
It's strange for, I guess, people of our generation, Daniel, because we're of a similar age. If we're fond of Gascoigne, or if we enjoyed watching him play, we look back at his life. And certainly this is what I did during reading the book, was that I hoped that, or I was frustrated. I was always trying to find out ways that it would have worked for Gazza in Italy. For example, if Dino Zoff had stayed on, if Zdenek Zeman hadn't come in as manager then and had this kind of autocratic rule, do you see any way in which it could have worked out for Gazza in Italy?
My hunch, and it is only a hunch, is that there is an element of poor psyche of his illness that made him kind of predisposed to eventually be the architect of his own downfall. That his brilliance, as the game became increasingly modern, and Paul kind of moved to Italy at a time when the Italians were far more professional than in terms of their footballer life than we were. We still very much had an old first division drinking culture. And he moved to a league that was probably as professional as the Premier League is now, but he did it in the early 90s. I cannot see how those two things realistically could ever have married together over the long term. I think that Paul would have needed a much more rigorous support network around him. One of the great shames about Gascoigne's career in Italy is that he was due to move out with Glenn Roeder, who's a former English football manager, who was his teammate at Newcastle and became a mentor for Paul, and was due to move out to Lazio with him, was due to get a coaching role with Lazio and kind of basically be his minder. And after the second injury where Paul was punched in a nightclub and delayed his move to Italy by several months, Glenn Roeder basically said, "I can't live like this. I can't live my life through someone who's so unreliable." And he called off his own move to Lazio. Maybe if he'd have moved with him and been there to support him, things might have been different. But my hunch is that he was kind of predisposed towards this sad downfall.
Yeah, I'm curious to kind of expound on that as Daniel Story joins us here on Caught Offside, talking about his book, Gazza in Italy. The idea of him being in Italy, I mean, Paul Gascoigne was such kind of a fragile personality. Was it something with Italy specific that may have led to kind of this self-destructive behavior? Or was it just going to be, no matter where he was, this was always a thing that was going to happen, regardless of city, country, it didn't matter?
I think you're absolutely right. I think it certainly emphasised his lack of support network. By its very nature, he was in a completely different country, in a completely different football culture. He didn't speak much Italian. He famously had these two minders, these two bodyguards that looked after him in Rome, and effectively ended up kind of, I don't know, almost lodging with him to keep him on the straight and narrow. But he kind of got them into these escapades. His family life was up and down. He had this girlfriend and the mother of his child, Cheryl, who was out and then couldn't hack it and then was back, and everything was constantly in a case, you know, state of flux with Gascoigne in Italy, and the very nature of Italian life, you know, our stereotypes of Italian life of bustle, of huge passion, everything was that was Paul in a nutshell, and it kind of emphasized and I don't know, it put everything of Paul, it put into stereo, and the way the Italian media also jumped on the back of that and basically, you know, to all intents and purposes, saw a story every time that he went out of his house. You know, he was incredibly unique in Italian football because he would, you know, he'd go drinking with the fans. He'd get into scrapes in town. He would go shopping on the morning of the Rome derby. Everything about Paul was larger than life, and the Italian media piled on that. And then they did, they thought they were getting a hooligan, and they intended to make the most of that reputation and sell copy through it.
Daniel, I'm going to ask you a bit more of a broader question. I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but you write extensively about football for Football 365. Your stuff is great, so I thought I'd try this one on you. If there was a player suffering with the mental health issues that Gascoigne faced now in Italy or England in 2018, are you confident that in this era he'd be treated with the requisite care and attention that he clearly didn't receive back in the mid-90s?
Yeah, I think there is a lot more available to footballers now. I think football in general is owed a huge amount of thanks for putting that in place, because it needed to, it really did. Now, and I know the vast increases in broadcast revenues and revenues in general make it easier to make the financial contribution to helping footballers, but it didn't have to happen, and I'm incredibly glad that it has. You know, I think almost once every couple of weeks now you read a broadsheet newspaper in this country that involves a current or former footballer talking about mental health issues. And I think for too long we overlooked that side of the game simply because we didn't want to know about it. And it asked difficult questions of ourselves, namely our treatment of sports stars and celebrities as kind of performing circus acts. So I am wholly confident that that has improved. It can always get better. And I think now, my main hope now is that we're in a place where it kind of organically gets better, so that the proper treatment and the proper assistance and the proper support networks in place actually, you know, almost fuel themselves, that we can never go back now. We can never ignore these issues. And yeah, I am confident of that. And that's a great thing to say.
Daniel, I know you said earlier in us speaking with you that the goal of the book is not necessarily set out to, you know, pass judgment on whether or not his time in Italy was a success or a failure. But I think by and large, more people will probably look at it as a disappointment other than anything else. What is that down to for you, if you had to attribute, you know, a certain element to that? Was it the injuries? Was it off the field? Was it coaching? Is there something you look at and think, if that was different, maybe this whole experience would have gone differently for him?
Yeah, I think very simply, if he hadn't have broken his leg of his own doing by tackling Gary Charles of Nottingham Forest, if he hadn't done that in the 1991 FA Cup final and had moved that summer as he was meant to, rather than a year down the line, I think that Lazio would have got the player that they signed. I think that Paul would have escaped some of the guilt that he felt for putting that move in jeopardy. And I think he would have escaped some of the mental demons that haunted him during his time in Italy. I think he would have had that support network around him, and it would have been a very different time there. Whether or not Lazio was the correct club for him, you know, there was talk of moving to Milan and Fabio Capello, and maybe that would have worked. But then Gascoigne's career is full of these ifs and buts. And in a way, that helps to create the legend, that helps to, you know, that those unknowables are all about Gascoigne's story. But I think it would have been a lot different if it had moved in 1991. And I have to say, I think having not moved for a year, I think it was the wrong move in 1992.
It's very prescient that we're talking about Gazza today, because you pick up the Telegraph this morning and Jason Burt, this very morning in the aftermath of the Spain-England game, Gareth Southgate was asked, how can England develop a player who can run a game in the way Thiago Alcantara has just done in Spain's victory at Wembley? To Southgate's response was simply, the only one in my lifetime is Gascoigne. So a nice easy one to finish up with, Daniel. Why is that the case?
Well, we didn't, for all the for all the very positive talk and of the process involved in St George's Park and kind of creating this England DNA and creating the next generation of footballers, which I am 100% on board with. And I think it was is long overdue and necessary. We didn't create Paul Gascoigne. Paul Gascoigne was created. Paul Gascoigne happened. He was a player with a sort of natural talent that you cannot develop, that someone has to have innate within them to come out. Now, you can make the best of players, and I don't think English football in the 90s and late 80s was the best place for Gascoigne to have been developed and nurtured. I don't think that goes without saying. And I think if he was born now, we maybe would be able to. But no, you do not develop a Paul Gascoigne. Gareth Southgate is absolutely right when he talks about, you know, he talks about players who was the most naturally talented player he ever played with. But there was no training session that ever improved Paul. You know, you speak to his former teammates and you speak to his former managers, and he joked around because it's a very cliched thing to say, but he basically completed football at the age of 21, 22. There was no way of him becoming more naturally talented than he was. So, yeah, it's the unanswerable question how you replace Paul Gascoigne. You basically cross your fingers and hope for that once-in-a-generation player to come round again.
Well, Daniel, it sounds fascinating because he's such a fascinating figure, as we said earlier. I guess that would be something I would end on with you. In writing this book, did you kind of come away from it upon completion feeling any differently about him than maybe before you started this project?
I think whenever you scratch into the surface of someone's personality and how that personality was treated and exploited basically in the media, it makes you angry. It obviously makes you upset. But you do have to remember that he was a product of his time. This was a celebrity culture and a tabloid culture, which, you know, there was a huge ratings war and there's a huge race for information, and Gascoigne unwittingly played a part of that. So yes, it makes you incredibly angry. It does make me confident, thankfully, and it's a happy ending that if a Paul Gascoigne was born again in this country, we would cherish him far more than Paul was cherished. And the sad thing is that we cherish Gascoigne in hindsight and a memory of what he could have been rather than what he is now. And that's an incredibly sad tale.
Well, imagine plugging him into that midfield in 98 instead of Hoddle saying you're not going. Could have been different.
Yeah, we will always miss a player like Gascoigne. And to be honest, every team will.
Yep, certainly. Daniel Story, great stuff, man. Gaza in Italy is the book. It comes out full release on September 20th. I believe it is out now on audiobook. Great stuff, man. We appreciate the time, and hopefully we'll catch up again maybe later in the season to see how the book is doing and to just talk some modern day.
To talk Nottingham Forest, obviously.
Yeah, we're never a good news story, so don't worry about that.
Good stuff, man. Thanks a lot, Daniel.
Cheers, thank you.
Our thanks to Daniel Story for giving us some time to help discuss his book that'll be coming out September 20th, and as we mentioned, available on audiobooks right now. Paul Gascoigne has always been such an intriguing figure. I guess the only guy I'm always trying to think in my head of who I would compare him to, like for prominent athletes in my life.
Okay.
I feel like Allen Iverson is one that comes to mind.
But Iverson's body of work is much more complete and consistent.
Right. But players with outrageous talent, naturally gifted, but who had some self-destructive tendencies.
Demons and...
And maybe those played some role in undermining whatever level of success they might have been able to go on and achieve.
He was always compared to George Best.
Uh-huh.
And I think the comparison is fair to a point, but I honestly, from my study of Best and the study of Gascoigne, I don't believe George Best. He obviously had a problem with addiction, but addiction was a symptom of Gascoigne's problem, not the entire problem. I'm sure you can apply that to Best too, but I feel as if Paul's mental health issues were much more profound.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book, and because it comes out soon, and it's something that I know you just had a chance to finish up the audiobook, and you were just like in awe of it. So we thought it would be fun to have Daniel on and talk a little bit about it.
And the book is good, but it's not just an endless ream of stories. This is not, you know, one of those after dinner speakers where it's just banter after banter. This actually delves into Gascoigne's psyche a little bit.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, quick break. We'll be back in just a minute here with a few thoughts on some of the internationals that have happened over the last few days, including USA-Brazil, some of the UEFA Nations League stuff. Back in one sec. Caught Offside is also brought to you today by ZipRecruiter. You know what's not smart, JJ? Job sites that overwhelm you with tons of wrong resumes.
You say that to me all the time.
Constantly. I would stand to believe that there's a few teams out there that could probably use ZipRecruiter for some help getting managerial positions or video coordinator positions and things like that.
Yeah, certainly.
With resumes that are actually useful to them. But you know what is smart? ZipRecruiter.com/offside. That's right. Because unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't wait for candidates to find you. ZipRecruiter finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply. So you get qualified candidates fast. No more sorting through the wrong resumes. No more waiting for the right candidates to apply. It's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from the hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. It's all very, very legit stuff. This is the real deal. And right now, listeners to this podcast can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. It's ZipRecruiter.com/offside. That's ZipRecruiter.com/offside. OFFSIDE. Offside. It's not plural.
Not offsides, guys.
People are desperate to put an S on the end of that, but it's don't.
American sacrifice. He was offsides.
ZipRecruiter.com/offside. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Oh, back now on Caught Offside. Happy New Year, by the way. It is Rosh Hashanah.
It is indeed. I wished you the best of the Jewish New Year last night.
I had a bit of an eventful Rosh Hashanah dinner at my my in-laws.
Did it involve unleavened bread?
No, that's the wrong holiday.
Damn it.
No, somebody fainted. It was kind of, you know, it's one of these like situations where it's not a huge house and the room gets like hot quickly and there's a lot of people.
Was it you?
No, it was not me.
Tell the truth.
It was not me. In fact, from the category of not all heroes wear capes, I would just like to say that after this happened, I opened a window and allowed cool air to rush in.
You are the hero
the
America
hero.
Needs.
Yeah. It was unnerving.
When someone collapses, it's very – especially when you know they fainted. It happens on the subway
but
all
you never,
the time.
But you never quite know – like right after it happens, you're like, oh, well, they fainted. And like paramedics came. Somebody called 911 and like they checked him out. He had low blood sugar.
From fasting.
It's, again, wrong holiday.
Sorry.
But in the moment, you don't exactly know that that's why what's happened. Like, people can kind of black out for any number of reasons.
He could have been in a moment of deep religious fervor.
That's a great point.
It overtook him so much.
That's a great point. But yeah, so that is how I rung in the new year. But happy Rosh Hashanah. Lashana Tova to all of you out there who are celebrating. Let's talk about some of what's going on a little bit. We're going to do another podcast later this week after USA and Mexico have played. Where we'll kind of give like more broad opinions on what we've seen from this batch of friendlies for the U.S. men's national team. But quickly, we figured we're here. We may as well say something about what happened against Brazil the other night. Look, nothing that really shocked me. Brazil were better. Of course, Brazil are better.
Yeah. I think the shocking part was in the stands where it was clearly not a sellout.
I don't even look at that stuff right now.
Brazil come to town and they come to the tri-state and we're turning a page. We got these young, exciting players on the field.
We're in a moment of like the low, this all happens in crests and waves. We are right now in like the low point of a dark valley.
And I suppose
we're on the ascent, but like the U.S. right now are just not – they're just not in a place where they're going to be attracting sellout crowds regardless of who the opponent is. Pulisic's not playing.
So why not play
Dempsey's
that in Red
retired.
Bull Arena?
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, maybe organizers of this thought, well, Brazil, that's a draw. That in itself could get a huge number. And thankfully, because of Brazil playing in this game – like there were a lot of people there, and it seemed like most of them were rooting for Brazil.
I think the soccer-specific stadiums in the U.S. need to be 35,000-40,000. It kind of makes more sense because I say Red Bull Arena, not going to fit the whole crowd into a 25,000-seater stadium. I mean,
I think soccer-specific stadiums are doing the right thing. You want them to be 40,000?
35.
So now you've got MLS regular season MLS matches that like right now they appear like a thing. Because you look at them and they're packed. I don't want to see empty seats. There's going to be empty seats if you're playing games at 40.
There's empty seats anyway. At least we could have internationals in them.
You still can. You could play these games in a 25,000.
Anyway, that's
arena.
By the
no,
by.
No, you're right. That's totally besides the point. A couple of things, I guess, that stood out to me. Douglas Costa, the way on that first goal that he just kind of took Anthony Robinson to school. And some of it was Douglas Costa. I mean, the ball that he played in to Firmino was perfect.
Right.
You can't play a ball any better than that. But like some of it was also a little bit self-destructive. I thought Anthony Robinson just took a poor angle. Maybe if he had played that differently, I'm sure things would have gone differently. So this is what these games are for.
But
really young players playing against really good players who are learning.
And also, the gap in where Anthony Robinson has played most of his young trade has been in League One. He's only recently in the Championship.
Yeah. And now he's playing. And now he's matched up against Douglas Costa in Brazil. It's a tough ask. That's what these games are for. You're learning now. Like I don't want to see anybody who's truly discouraged off of this. And in fairness, I didn't get any of those tweets. I haven't talked to anybody who felt that way. So I think everyone has taken a pretty measured approach to this.
2-0 is nothing to be ashamed of.
No, and maybe it could have been more. I mean, Brazil were fairly dominant throughout this game. The U.S. had a couple, footholds throughout in patches. I know off the corner kick, Weston McKennie had an opportunity where maybe his first touch was just a little bit heavy. Had he gotten a better touch on it, maybe he would have had a better attempt on net. But overall, I'm not looking at these games really to evaluate how good our team is. It's just like in some ways I almost hope that they fail in some of these moments because I want like Anthony Robinson now learned a little bit something about how what his spacing needs to be,
and
when he's playing
we've
against
learned
a player like that.
That good results in friendlies
don't mean anything.
Teach you a thing.
No.
So maybe defeats are better. There's more coachable moments.
Yeah, and that also brings me to some of the thought about Dave Sarakin, who I was reading a stat. I think it was from Jeff Carlisle, where for all the kind of the positivity that there has been about where we're at and where we're at under him during this kind of weird interim period. I think it was Jeff that said 7 games, 7 goals for the U.S.
Yeah.
And that's with three goals coming against just Bolivia alone.
We don't have an out-and-out striker outside of Altidore. We don't. We don't have a guy, certainly not one that's in form. Bobby Wood doesn't fulfill that, and I don't think he was ever a natural finisher. Jassy Zard is too erratic, although he's set up to succeed in Columbus with the way they play. But again, this is a step up when you're playing Brazil, and we need a centre forward, be it the kid that's at Fortuna. Maybe he steps in. Maybe Josh Sargent. Although I honestly feel Josh Sargent will actually emerge more as a number 10.
Really?
As a creative player. I don't think he'll be an out-and-out goal scorer either. So
what do you envision then? Sargent as a number 10 and they put Pulisic out on the left?
Maybe Sargent.
Right, I guess.
Pulisic will probably be the creative force in that team. And
Sargent will be
He may have to drop deeper. Pulisic may have to take on a different role in this side.
I don't want him dropping.
To collect the ball. Maybe he has to. And then Sargent is further up the field. I'm speculating.
Yeah, no.
I'm speculating here. But right now, as we sit here, we don't have a guy who's banging in 25 goals a season in any decent level.
No.
That's a worry.
Yeah, of course it is. I
can tell you, as I'm in the post-Robbie Keane era for Ireland, it's tough.
Yeah, we'll talk about them in a second because it's been a bad few days for the Republic. But I guess just to kind of finish up on your point about not having a true striker, it would be great if that would just emerge organically and next thing you know, all of a sudden, Josh Sargent's getting regular minutes for Werder Bremen and he's scoring regular goals. Like that would be great if that just happened. But here in this moment right now, I think I'm comfortable with let's fix the defending first. Because I think that was kind of what undercut them more than anything else during qualifying.
Yeah, and again, international football, let's demystify it. Organization is key.
Right.
Iceland, Northern Ireland, all these teams, that's where they started. You must be able to put out a back four, back five, whatever formation you want, and have it tight and compact. That's your basis. And
right.
You're so right about that. And all the creativity up the field doesn't mean anything if you're leaking at the back.
Right. What do we talk about when we look at the qualifying campaign? The U.S. scored goals. Didn't they score the most goals or second most goals of any team in qualifying? But they were leaking goals like crazy.
I've banished that table from my mind. But for example, the opening salvo against Costa Rica, I remember Bobby Wood and Costa Rica away, Bobby Wood and Pulisic creating chances. You know, it wasn't like we weren't able to get at them. But what was going on at the other end? It's like I always say, there's no point having a beautifully furnished living room if the kitchen's on fire.
Absolutely. So I think we'll have a little bit better of a gauge. Not even. But Tuesday night, they'll play Mexico, which is an opponent that the United States believes that they should be beating, regardless of what sort of transitional period we're in. I think that's just that's what this rivalry is. There's never a moment where the U.S. plays Mexico and American fans don't think we should win this game. So, you know, friendly or not, I think that will shed a little bit more light against an opponent that the U.S. feels that they're more kind of in tune with, rather than Brazil or France, the last couple who, yeah, that's great to get, you know, to get the experience of playing a team like that. But I don't know if that's necessarily a true gauge of where this team is at. So we'll find that out Tuesday, 8:30, I believe, is kickoff for that. And you and I will talk more about that later this week when we reconvene. Before we get out, a couple mentions on the UEFA Nations League.
Yeah.
England fall to Spain.
Fun game, though. And a game that felt like it had a competitive edge to it, which it did. So, whatever. Look, it's a shambles of a system. It's confusing and people don't like it. But at least when you turn on your TV to watch a UEFA Nations League game, you can, for the most part, say, well, the players out there are taking it seriously. And Spain and England certainly did that. For moments in that game, long periods, Spain just dominated England. But then England still had enough creative nous to be in the game right to the end, possibly could have equalised. So it was a good, entertaining game. Certainly Ryan Giggs is delighted with his start in competitive football, absolutely hammering the Republic of Ireland.
What happened?
Ireland didn't have their full team, but mostly Wales were just so much better. Ireland was so disorganised. Shocking. Like, you have a defender, Kieran Clark, who looked like he was playing League Two. Whereas we know under Rafa Benitez, he's much better coached than that. It's been a calamitous 10 days. And now we have the release of something that's doing the rounds, which I don't really want to talk about from a journalistic point of view.
Well, set it up for what it's worth.
There is audio going round of a senior figure in the Irish camp, a player, who goes into detail explaining exactly what happened in the spat between Harry Arthur, Jonathan Walters, and Roy Keane.
But the reason that you're hesitant to name this player is because it's hard to officially verify that it is who the audio is portrayed to be.
If I had to stand in court and say, do you think that's his voice, because he has done media work in Ireland, I'm 100% sure it's him. But well, I have no way to verify it.
Well, here's what I would
tell
you.
But every journalist on Twitter is in... where he's unmentionable, he's unnameable, but we everybody knows who he is.
Something like this recently happened here in the U.S. with a catcher for the San Diego Padres, this guy Will Myers, who was playing Fortnite, and I guess him and his buddies were playing, and they were streaming it, but
right.
He didn't know that they were streaming it. And so I guess, I've never played Fortnite, but I guess while you're playing, you can just talk.
Trash talk.
So he's telling his buddies about their manager, and how he says the guy's just been a disaster lately. He's got us doing these ridiculous drills at this stage in the season. What is he doing? And then his friend is like, dude, I'm streaming right now. And there's silence. And then they all just kind of burst out laughing because, like, what else are you supposed to say? And then he didn't hide behind, oh, that wasn't me. The next day he issued an apology. And he said, you know, I love the managers, just like right now we're in a tough spot. Will Myers handled it pretty well. Is that, like, in any way comparable to this, or is that – like, I don't know how Fortnite works.
Well,
if it's Will Myers, is it like it's 100% him? There's no way around it?
Well, you will hear his voice very clearly.
But that's the same case with this Irish player.
Absolutely. Well, I would have, if I was, what's his name, Will Myers?
Yeah,
Right in the middle of the silence after realizing it's been streamed, I would have gone, Leroy Jenkins.
I just run it.
That
there.
Is the only,
guns blazing.
Yeah, that is the only way to save yourself.
But anyway, so this unnamed Irish player who is very much named, if you go on.
Well, someone's betrayed him. Well, first of all, why is he recording this? Because in WhatsApp, it's so easy to forward audio messages and videos and stuff. They've made it very, very user-friendly.
Yeah.
And this thing's gone everywhere. So, and top journalists, guys who would have interviewed him.
So I'm not familiar with WhatsApp. So just so what he did, he's in a group on WhatsApp with a few friends.
A few friends.
And he sent them an audio message talking about all the crap that's gone on within the Irish camp.
Because he goes, well, lads.
So he thinks he's just sending this to a couple buddies. So the fact that this is now public means one of his quote-unquote buddies released this to the media.
Right. Well, we're assuming, like, you can send audio in a different fashion, but I'm just trying to think, what other way do people, I mean, people don't really, how do you record? Maybe it's a voicemail that was recorded and then sent to WhatsApp. But it sounds, the way he goes, "Well, lads," means
he thinks he's talking to
the group.
Safe company.
Safe people, friends. It's gone everywhere.
And he goes on into incredible detail explain what has happened between Roy Keane, Jonathan Walters, and Harry Arter.
Correct. And I mean, Martin O'Neill has had a press conference as Ireland play Poland tomorrow night. And he said some of the detail doesn't tally with what Roy says. But, I mean, that's not enough of a denial. There's a leak in the camp. Imagine being player.
There's not a leak in the camp. This is the leak.
Yeah. Like, player X. Imagine being player X right now. I can't even say his name because I can't prove it. Not ethically sound.
Well, here's what we'll say. Well, let's sit here for a moment and pretend. I mean, so what he essentially says in here is that Roy Keane has a massive problem with Jonathan Walters and Harry Arter, and I guess
for not
training
during the friendly games at the start of the summer.
Right. And reading into the way Roy Keane feels about them, it's almost like he looks at them as like a problem, like symbolic of the problem of today's modern athlete.
Very much so, in the way, are you professionals?
Yeah, and he's just riding them.
Mm. But the language is
profane.
Yeah, and it in the case of what's said about Arter, it feels like an unnecessary personal attack.
And in his attacks, Jonathan Walters allegedly they get into it.
Yes.
Have to be restrained from one another. And the part that I found most unsettling is that, so Roy Keane is the coach or an assistant coach on this team. Jonathan Walters is just a player. After all this goes down, allegedly, Walters sends Roy Keane a text message saying, "Hey, I'm up in my hotel room. Seems like you have a problem with me.
Let's talk it out.
If you want to come up here," he even says it's causing tension within the squad. It's not good. Let's talk about this and move beyond. That's the player to the coach. And Roy Keane rejects it and says, "No.
Let's just ignore each other."
Yeah.
Like real schoolyard stuff.
That to me is like a reversal of who's the adult in the room. Like, I think the coach should be the one, the assistant coach here, or somebody, Martin O'Neill, somebody needs to step in and try to smooth this over if it is in fact causing tension.
Who's Dave Sarakin's assistant coach? I'm guessing it might be Tab Ramos, but I don't know. Who's the assistant coach of Brazil? Don't know. Who's the assistant coach of France? Don't know. Steve Walford, just because his name was mentioned regularly this summer. It was almost Gareth Southgate and Steve Walford together, right, as chums. Keane is the most visible assistant coach in international football, and it's not working out. His idea, the whole point of him in this world-class management team was him to, as Ireland's greatest player, one of the most decorated, to inspire and to make players like Declan Rice, like Harry Arter, want to play for him. And this seems like the exact opposite is happening.
Yeah.
Like, he is comparing their standards to his own lofty standards and just destroying them.
Which is sometimes why it's difficult for great players to be coaches.
Well, and this is all allegedly.
Right. I think we've said that enough.
I think there's a body of evidence though coming together.
Well, look, if Martin O'Neill is holding press conferences addressing it and validating at least some of it, if he's saying, "Well, Roy Keane has a different view on some of this," well,
he said that.
If he said, "This is what? What is this? None of this
is
true."
By the way, Martin O'Neill started this last week by saying Harry isn't in, and talked about an altercation with Keane. So O'Neill tried to, in some weird way, 10 days ago, get ahead of this.
So what's the end game here? Because it's clearly, like, if you look at the result of Ireland and what happened against Wales, I don't want to say it's all because there's tension between Roy Keane and certain players.
This is all feeds into a larger thing. Wales were excellently coached, have better players, but a 17-year-old ran the show, Ampadu from Chelsea, who, by the way, Ampadu's father played under-21s for Ireland alongside Roy Keane. So, anyway, whatever.
This is in some way manifested itself to become not just a problem between people, but a problem within the team. And you can't have that. So what are they waiting for? Like, is Roy Keane that integral and that important to whatever Ireland is going to go on and do that they can't get rid of him, despite the fact that it seems like there's been like a mini mutiny?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. Roy Keane has been here throughout the entire campaigns from 2013. Our best results have featured, certainly our best away results, Wales away last November, and Austria away in November 2016. Both wins. featured Harry Arter prominently. So Harry Arter is not somebody we can afford to be marginalising and sidelining in this manner. So I don't think Keane's integral. I think the players are integral, and I'm not sure what Keane's role is other than berating them.
I feel like this all gets charted up to that one category of never meet your heroes. You know, like a lot of these guys on Ireland probably worshipped Roy Keane, and now he's just like the worst to them.
Yeah.
Like I once met Wilt Chamberlain. I was a little kid.
Oh, no.
I met Wilt Chamberlain. I went to like some autograph expo thing in Philadelphia, and he was like one of the guests there who was going to be signing stuff. And I happened to be leaving as he was walking in with like his people.
Hey, Wilt.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Wilt. Oh, my God. Can I have your autograph? He could not have been nastier. Like, I was probably 11 years old.
Oh, God.
And it wasn't just me. There were other people, too. He could not have been nastier. You can pay for it like everyone else. Because going there for an autograph signing. And
one
like,
of
you
the
wait,
grand old men of the NBA.
Couldn't have been nastier. Now, look, I don't want to – I almost feel bad saying this because, like, it's not fair – to judge somebody off of like one individual moment like that. He could have been having a bad day. Also, he's right. Like, he's showing up at an autograph signing because people need to pay for this. So, like, I get where he's coming from. But I will say that's my only interaction with Wilt Chamberlain, who's like the legend of legends. And it did not go well.
Oh.
Did not go well.
God.
Yeah.
That is devastating.
Yeah. So sometimes it's just best to just kind of like leave your heroes in this like mythical realm,
right?
And not actually.
But you were an 11-year-old boy looking for an autograph.
Yeah,
you weren't coming to play for his team.
Right.
You know, you weren't
right.
drafted to the NBA.
Right.
There's got to be a difference there. So don't play for Roy Keane.
Yeah, I guess not.
Or Martin O'Neill.
And maybe people disagree. Maybe there's people that think like some modern day players could use a little bit of tough love. I don't know if this applies here.
Andrew, yeah. We heard some of the context. That's not tough love. That's just...
bullying.
A verbal berating. That's just throwing profanity at someone.
Yeah. It wasn't pretty.
No.
It was not pretty. We'll be back later this week with more on, I guess, some of how the UEFA Nations League is progressing. We'll have a look at the upcoming weekend. A big Caught Offside Cup is coming.
Ooh, here it comes.
I'm a little bit nervous.
You should be.
You're probably feeling pretty good. And, of course, we will, as I said, look at the United States and Mexico, which should be a fun one on Tuesday night. Hey, my friend, I enjoyed this. As always, our thanks to Daniel Story. Like we said, the book is called Gaza in Italy. I highly suggest you check it out because he's such an enigmatic figure, and it's a fascinating look at a really tumultuous time in a tumultuous life.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Available on audiobook now. Check it out on Amazon. Full release on September 20th. Hey, to you I say...
take you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.